sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. As many of you already know, the 9/11 Truth Movement is large, worldwide, and continues to grow. We span the political spectrum because it's not about ideology. It's about wanting the truth. The consequences of 9/11 have altered our country and the world in a very negative way. We now have bipartisan support for torture, a permanent war on terror, with new groups of terrorists popping up at convenient times and in convenient locations for the benefit of the power elite and for the corporations that are making a killing as part of the war machine. We have indefinite detentions without trial, a Bill of Rights that's gone with the wind, and executive power grabs, secret renditions, trillions missing from the Pentagon, continuity of government renewed yearly by the president. You might want to look that up, continuity of government. A president who now has the authority to kill American citizens if he suspects they're involved in terrorism. No proof, no trial, just a suspicion. We are a country in very serious financial debt, and we have killed more than 1 million innocent people and displaced millions more in the global war on terror, which, if you've been doing your homework, you know is a hoax. And we've lost thousands of U.S. soldiers and have thousands more seriously injured. And the wars are all heating up again. Members of the 9/11 Truth Movement may disagree on certain aspects of what happened and some of the evidence, but one thing that we all agree on is that the 9/11 Truth Movement wants a real investigation, one that is independent of the government, and one that has subpoena power. There are currently two possible avenues for a new investigation, and we'll talk about those today on the show. The first one is the ballot initiative process in New York City. They tried to get a new investigation into 9/11 on the ballot in 2009, but it was blocked by the New York City Council. And they just tried again this year to get an investigation into the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, which was the third building that collapsed on 9/11 and that wasn't hit by a plane and that was not mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report except for in one footnote. The first attempt was called NYC CAN, and the more recent one was called the High-Rise Safety Initiative. With me today to give us an update on the High-Rise Safety Initiative is Ted Walter, the director of the organization. Ted Walter, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl.
Yeah, now you just completed the second round of trying to get an investigation, in this case into Building 7, on the New York City ballot. Can you talk to us a little bit about what happened to that? I understand the court ruled against it. Maybe you could give us the details on that.
Sure. So our campaign was called the High-Rise Safety Initiative. And what we were trying to do was to get a referendum on the ballot in New York City that would have amended the New York City Charter to require the Department of Buildings to investigate the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, as well as any future high-rise collapses. And so in New York State, there's a process that allows for voters to amend their city charter. You have to collect at least 30,000 signatures. And then if the city council doesn't vote in favor of your initiative, you need to gather another 15,000. And so we collected the required number of signatures. However, there's another hurdle, which is the hardest hurdle to clear as far as getting something on the ballot in New York, and that is for the petition to be compliant with all the laws of New York State and the country. And there's a lot of like specific requirements as far as things that your proposed charter amendment is allowed to do or not allowed to do. And so like 5 years ago, the city challenged the petition, saying that certain aspects of it were not legally valid. And we had to go to court to challenge the city's determination. And unfortunately, a week ago, the judge in our case ruled that certain parts of our petition were not legally valid. And there are three main arguments that the city brought against the petition. One of those arguments we prevailed on, The other two, we didn't, and I can go into detail. It's quite a lot of legal jargon, and it's very, and a lot of it's not very common sense, but the upshot is that we didn't get on the ballot.
And then you decided not to appeal, correct?
Yeah, we decided not to appeal because there were two issues that we were still disputing, and one of them we felt we had a very low probability of winning on. And we felt that if we appealed and we had such a low chance of winning on that, the other issue is much more fundamental to whether our petition could ever be successful. But the issue that we felt we didn't have a chance on is one that could actually be fixed in the future, which has to do with how these investigations would be funded. And we felt that if we appealed, we would make it very easy for the appellate court to rule, just completely agree with the lower court, and therefore solidify the lower court's finding on the other fundamental issue, which is they said that our petition is merely advisory, meaning it's only a symbolic opinion poll, which we disagree with strongly. So if we essentially, once we felt that we had a very low chance of getting on the ballot due to the financing plan, we felt that our main priority was to preserve our ability to try this again in the future with a revised financing plan. And we would diminish our chances of doing that if we appealed, and probably the appellate division would just affirm the lower court's decision.
Yeah, and what was the problem with the financing plan, according to the court?
Yeah, the idea was that the investigations would be funded with a surcharge on construction permit fees. So anybody, whether they're building a high-rise or they're just building a small house or there are various other things that people need to get a permit for from the Department of Buildings, they would pay us a very small 1% surcharge of whatever their actual fee was. And the city argued, and the court found in favor of the city, that the surcharge was in fact a tax and not a fee, and therefore under the New York State Constitution would require state approval to be levied. And already in the past, courts have found that any type of tax the city is not already authorized to levy on its own without further approval is not allowed under this ballot initiative process. So we got into it. Basically, what we were disputing was whether this was a fee or a tax. If it's a fee, then the city's authorized to impose it. If it's a tax, then it's not. And so we lost on that argument.
So are there a lot of problems in the process of getting the signatures and getting on the ballot? Seems like,
yeah,
it's a difficult process.
It's an extraordinarily difficult process. In most states that have active referenda processes, it's much easier to get something on the ballot. You're allowed to amend a local city charter or pass an ordinance. You know, you can pass any type of law, basically. And there aren't all these restrictions on what you can do. Most importantly, you will submit the language. Typically, in most places, you'd submit the language before you actually start circulating the petition. However, in New York State, that's not the case. So it's basically on the voters to go out and collect tens of thousands of signatures and then submit the petition and then find out from the city whether the city thinks it's legally valid or not. And the city doesn't give any assistance or guidance prior to the submission of the petition. So it is a very challenging process and a costly process. There are significant chances of not succeeding, and that's been the track record in New York City. Over the last 50 years, out of the dozen or so ballot initiatives that have been attempted, only two have successfully made it onto the ballot. Most of them have been challenged by the city, and the courts have found in favor of the city.
Were there lessons learned in this, and do you plan on doing it again in the future?
So yeah, each time we do this, we learn a lot. I think the first time around, our petition was fatally flawed in a lot of ways. The second petition, the one that we just did this year, was much stronger in many regards. And so it's like this time around, we got very close, we feel like, to having something on the ballot. And we learned a lot in this case this year about the details of having a legally viable financing plan. And we think that there's a very good chance that we could redraft the petition to have a financing plan that would survive this legal hurdle. And so we are considering doing it again. The one issue, and I spoke to this just a few moments ago, the issue where we would potentially have problems in the future is on that other issue of whether or not the court thinks that our petition is merely advisory, in other words, just an opinion poll, or whether indeed it's a true amendment to the city charter and that it substantially changes the way that the city government operates. And because the lower court has found against us on that issue now, there's a good chance that they would find against us on that issue 2 years from now, which is the next election, and that if we wanted to win on that, and if we wanted to get on the ballot, we'd essentially be assuming that we have to win on appeal, which is certainly conceivable, certainly possible, if there are no other issues with the petition, that we could win on that issue, because we feel like that's where the court truly wronged us. We don't feel that their finding on the financing plan was incorrect or unfair, but we do believe that what they said about the petition being merely advisory is truly wrong and something that we could win on in the future if we did this again and then we appealed.
Well, I for one hope you do it again. I think it's really good, even if you don't win it, you put 9/11 in the public eye, letting
Thank
people
you.
Know that it's a challenge and letting our government officials know that we're not giving up. We're still here and we want answers.
Absolutely. Out. Thank you. Well, I'm really glad to know that you feel it was worth it, even though we didn't get on the ballot this time and we're still working towards it. And we think that it's possible and perhaps it is our best chance of getting a new investigation. And so that's why we continue to work at it.
What kind of response have you gotten since you've let people know that we lost the battle there?
Very, very positive, you know, very much consistent with what you just said and the idea that it was a great attempt and that we have to keep on trying. And yeah, people want us to consider doing it again. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah, that's great news. Ted, is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you want to share with the listeners?
Well, as I said, it's a very challenging process, but I still think it's very, very tempting to look at it all and be discouraged and also feel that it's just a completely corrupt process that can never succeed. And I agree to some extent. The system is makes it incredibly difficult to succeed. However, I think that there is some fairness to the process where, well, not fairness, but if we really drafted something that was bulletproof, that even a judge who wanted to get in our way or whatever wouldn't be able to, that it really is possible to succeed if we draft a good enough petition. And so I hope that's what we're able to do, though we're not committed to it for sure. We really have to look at all the details. But we do believe that it's possible and that the system, while it's really set against the voters, is not completely corrupt or insurmountable.
And I understand what you're saying. It's a really big endeavor and costs a lot of money, so you really want to be sure that you have a good shot at it before you take it on again.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks again for all your efforts with it. And as I say, I think it was a huge success in the fact that it educated lots of New Yorkers and other people and that it lets our officials know we're still here.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Ted Walter, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thanks for having me.
Again, that was Ted Walter, the director of the recent High-Rise Safety Ballot Initiative in New York City. To learn more about that effort, the website is nyccan.org. So nyccan.org. And now let's look at the second effort at investigating 9/11. It's called 28 Pages and refers to the new attempt to get the 28 pages that were redacted from the 2002 congressional inquiry into 9/11 declassified. But before getting into this new declassification effort of those 28 pages, I think it's important to discuss the 2002 congressional inquiry and talk a little bit about a few of the players involved. In December of 2001, the Senate voted for a joint congressional inquiry into 9/11. And it was announced on Valentine's Day in February of 2002, and it was to be conducted by the Joint House and Senate Intelligence Committees. And of course, Bush and Cheney tried to stop the investigation or limit its scope. The co-chairs of the inquiry were Senator Bob Graham and House Member Porter Goss. Both were from Florida, and both were the chairs of their respective intelligence committees in Congress. This is what author Kevin Ryan says about the Joint Congressional Inquiry in his book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects. Quote, in the months following 9/11, both Goss and Senator Graham rejected calls for an investigation. Tom Daschle agreed to an inquiry that would be restricted to intelligence issues only. Goss immediately made it clear that the inquiry would not be looking for guilt or accountability with regard to 9/11. Throughout the inquiry, the approach taken by Goss and Graham was one of uncritical deference to the Bush administration and the intelligence community. Unquote. Perhaps some information about these two co-chairs will shed some light on why they didn't want an investigation into 9/11 and why the congressional investigation itself may not be any more reliable than the 9/11 Commission report, which we know to be a sham. Let's start with Porter Goss, who Kevin Ryan considers a legitimate 9/11 suspect in his book, Another 19. Much of the information on Porter Goss that you'll hear today comes from his book, and some from the late Philip Marshall's book, The Big Bamboozle. Porter Goss was born in Waterbury, Connecticut, and went to Yale University, where he was a member of the secret society Book and Snake. He was recruited by the CIA in 1961. It has been reported that he was one of the CIA officers employed by Operation Mongoose, the covert U.S. project to get rid of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. And here's a long direct quote from the book, Another 19. Goss worked for the CIA's Directorate of Operations as a covert operative in Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Mexico, and Western Europe. His primary role was to infiltrate trade unions in the fight against the perceived threat of communism. In his book, Barry and the Boys, journalist Daniel Hopsicker published a photograph that he had received from the wife of CIA operative and drug trafficker Barry Seal. Hopsicker claimed that the picture was taken at a nightclub in Mexico City on January 22, 1963, and included members of a team called Operation 40. One of these men, according to Hopsicker, was Porter Goss. Operation 40 was a CIA-sponsored team of operatives accused of conducting assassinations. According to a senior member of the Cuban security apparatus, it was funded by an important group of businessmen headed by George Bush Sr. and Jack Crichton, both Texas oilmen. Operation 40 would assassinate military or political members of a target foreign country, as well as those suspected of being agents of those foreign countries. There have even been suspicions that the group was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. In 1970, Goss came down with a bacteriological infection that nearly killed him. The following year, he left the CIA and purchased a home on Sanibel Island in Florida. Starting in 1974, he spent 8 years in Sanibel City government. Then, in an unusual move by then-Governor Bob Graham, Republican Goss was appointed to fill a Democrat vacancy as commissioner of Lee County. Later in 1988, Goss was elected to the U.S. Congress as a Republican representative from the 13th District. The 13th District included Venice, where Huffman Aviation was located. After the district was rezoned, Goss became the representative from District 14, where he was reelected 4 times. In the few years prior to 9/11, the alleged terrorists used Goss's district in Charlotte County as one of their main bases of operations. The area that Goss represented was known for a long history of CIA-linked drug running. In fact, the man who ran Huffman Aviation, the flight school where Muhammad Atta and friends trained, was arrested for drug trafficking in 2012. The drug trafficking in Goss's district went on while he was the congressional representative there and while the brother of Stratasex Marvin Bush, Jeb Bush, was governor. What's more, Jeb Bush was noted arriving at Huffman Aviation within a day after the 9/11 attacks to recover and escort documents from Huffman Aviation back to Washington. In 1996, Goss became chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Later, Goss oversaw the House Intelligence Committee's inquiry into the drug and gun trafficking that supported the Nicaraguan Contras. The Goss inquiry covered up the CIA's involvement and ignored the evidence that Vice President Bush was involved. In the years just before 9/11, Goss continued to be a stalwart defender of the new Bush administration's policies and plans. He supported the deceptions used to terrify Americans about Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. He repeated false claims that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were behind the 9/11 attacks. He promoted the idea that Syria and Iran needed to be attacked to defend American interests, and he covered up the use of White House-approved torture. In August 2001, Goss traveled along with Senators John Kyle and Bob Graham to Pakistan to meet with President Pervez Musharraf. Perhaps coincidentally, Senator Kyle's state of Arizona was another major base of operations for the alleged 9/11 hijackers, as described in part by FBI agent Ken Williams's famous Phoenix memo. Taliban leaders were involved in Goss's Pakistan meeting. So that's a little bit of background information on Porter Goss. And as you can see, he had a relationship with Senator Bob Graham before 9/11. This is what Kevin Ryan says about the 9/11 Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 that these two were the co-chairs of. The inquiry could not convince Director of Central Intelligence Tenet to be interviewed, and operational cables and certain other documents could not be viewed other than at CIA headquarters. Further restrictions included that no copies could be made. Clearly, protecting the CIA's secret was more important than the safety of potential victims of terrorism. As with the CIA, the FBI would not allow the joint inquiry to take notes or to make copies of documents deemed sensitive by the Bureau. Yet Goss did not complain. It was claimed by insiders that Goss and Graham exercised near total control over the panel, forbidding the inquiry's staff to speak to other lawmakers. Other members of the inquiry complained that the two co-chairmen withheld information and controlled the process. One way in which Graham and Goss controlled the investigation was to ask the FBI to look into panel members who might have leaked information. This resulted in the FBI investigating the inquiry as the inquiry was investigating the FBI. Goss and Graham, who represented the areas where CIA operations and drug running had become common and terrorist training had occurred, wanted to keep the facts about 9/11 under wraps. They were, however, curiously coy about one major U.S. ally, Saudi Arabia. The report from the joint inquiry, which was partially released in December 2002, and then finalized in July 2003, appeared to imply Saudi government involvement in the 9/11 attacks. A significant section of the report, 28 pages in length, was never released, but hints were made that it contained evidence implicating the Saudis. Senator Graham continued for the next decade to suggest that Saudi Arabia may have played a role in the 9/11 attacks. Others like Richard Clark joined Graham in making these suggestions, yet they always seemed to ignore the many interesting connections between U.S. leaders and Saudi Arabian royals. Goss is also reported as saying, "I don't know exactly how the plot was hatched. I don't know the where, the when, and the why, and the who in every instance." Years later, Graham complained that the White House had disrupted the inquiry's work. He said, "Looking back at it, I think we were clearly set up by Dick Cheney and the White House. They wanted to shut us down. They wanted to shut down a legitimate congressional inquiry that might raise questions in part about whether their own people had aggressively pursued al-Qaeda in the days prior to the September 11th attacks. The vice president attempted to manipulate the situation, and he attempted to manipulate us. But if his goal was to get us to back off, he was unsuccessful." According to Graham, Goss was of the same opinion. But the idea that Goss felt obstructed by the White House does not make sense in view of Goss's own actions. For one thing, as a congressman, Goss had been and would continue to be essentially a Bush administration cheerleader. Additionally, there was no evidence that Goss was in any way interested in achieving truth or justice with regard to the crimes of 9/11. So now let's look at what these two guys are doing after being co-chairs of the joint inquiry into 9/11. Porter Goss went on to become the Director of Central Intelligence in September 2004, where he blocked House investigations into the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal, and he supported the destruction of the CIA torture tapes that had formed the basis of the 9/11 Commission report. Goss resigned as Director of Central Intelligence in May of 2006. In 2008, and you're going to love this one, he became chairman of the Office of Congressional Ethics. Senator Bob Graham retired from public life in January of 2005. He was appointed as co-chair in 2010 by Obama on the National Commission on BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling. He was a commissioner on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and chairman of the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism. He currently serves as chairman of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Center, a 501c3 not-for-profit research organization, and he also serves as a member of the CIA External Advisory Board and as chair of the Board of Overseers of the Bob Graham Center for Public Service at the University of Florida. They both failed to point out that the evidence also leads to other countries being involved in 9/11 as well as people within our own government. And they were both having breakfast on the morning of 9/11 with the head of Pakistani intelligence, Mahmoud Ahmed, who was said to have given the go-ahead to wire $100,000 to alleged 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta. So please keep all of this info in mind as this push for the release of the 28 redacted pages moves forward. While I think we have a right to know what's in these 28 pages, are we being set up to blame 9/11 solely on Saudi Arabia as a way to distract from others clearly connected to the evidence, like Kevin Ryan's Another 19 and the other countries involved? Perhaps the 28 pages will never be released, but the repetition of the Saudi involvement will be in our brains forever. Perhaps those 28 pages say nothing about Saudi Arabia. Like the 9/11 commissioners, Porter Goss and Bob Graham also started to distance themselves from their report, saying that the government was trying to block them, etc. And I believe this happened because of the number of people questioning 9/11 continued to grow and is still growing, and includes many prominent people from around the world. These guys are protecting their own behinds. To learn more about the efforts to declassify these 28 redacted pages, you can go to the website 28pages.org. And that's the digit 28, so 28pages.org. And you can also find information about this on the new website, 911outreach.org. And again, that's 911outreach.org. And to learn more about Kevin Ryan, you can go to his website, digwithin.org. And I encourage you to get a copy of his book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects, which came out in 2013. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.